So thank you so much for coming. I'm really excited to have the opportunity to talk to you this morning about my research. And so what we'll be talking about is learning and becoming, the influence of social identities on teaching and learning processes. And so most of my work is in the K-12 school setting, but I also, particularly now, am thinking about how this informs teaching and learning in the college setting. And I'm actually working on a piece thinking about how teaching about difference, social equity, informs what students know and understand from at the college site. And so my goals for the morning, for the lecture, is to introduce you to research on identities from a few fields, cultural studies and anthropology in particular. I'm going to discuss a small piece of my work. So this project was a year-long ethnographic study in two urban classrooms in a northeast city. And within this study, I'm particularly going to talk about how teacher discourse, what's said in the classroom, how this informs students' identities, right? And I'll present some findings from this work, particularly what happened with the interactions between teachers and students in the classroom. And then towards the end, talk about what implication does this have, not only for classroom practices, but also for the ways in which we think about and theorize about how identities get constructed. So that's my plan. And please feel free to kind of raise a hand, interrupt me, and I'll try to do a good job of kind of defining my terms as I go. So the larger study here were the research questions I was interested in, thinking about how identities of teachers and students are constructed and co-constructed. And by that I mean, how does my interaction between you not inform only who I am in the moment, but also how you are, and that exchange informs what happens to our identities and to the space of the classroom. So in some ways we're shaping the culture of the classroom and what kinds of norms and practices are in place there. So the second question is what I'll spend more time attending to. That's how does who the teacher and students are and how they interact, how does this inform the classroom discourse? What's said, the utterances, the particular statements, and what does this mean for both teaching practices and student learning, right? How does what you say, what you emphasize, how you engage me as a student inform my participation in the classroom and how I'm engaging in the learning process? So that's what we'll think about today. The larger project traces the development of identities of the students and teachers through these interactions. And I focus on this because I believe that identity construction is an integral part of the learning process. It's not an ancillary thing. It's connected to what I am going to get out and how I'm going to engage the content in the classroom. So as educators, I believe that we have to have a deep understanding of how students' identities and their action shape teachers and vice versa. And we need to begin to understand this because we want to know how the construction of self informs the act of teaching from the teacher side and the process of learning from the learner side. I also think it's important because in order to provide good education, it's not just about having a really strong research-based curriculum. It's not only about having rigorous standards or teachers kind of faithfully carrying out this type of curriculum in a school setting and assessing to make sure it's in place. It's really about the relationships between teachers and students, the beliefs they hold about one another, and the particular goals they bring to the process, to the educational process. And so that's why I think what I research, why I research what I do and why I think it matters. So as I said, I'm going to focus more on this second question, how teachers and students' interactions inform the discourses. So this is a graphic, so we all think differently. This may help some of you to kind of frame what I'm up to. And there are multiple kinds of exchanges that are going on. My focus was the interaction between teacher and student. That was the focus, the unit of my analysis. So I tried to document these in many different ways. But one of the ways was to identify 5 students in each classroom and pay particular attention to the exchanges, both verbal and nonverbal, written, all sorts of ways. What happened and how did this inform how teachers understood what was going on and how students did. So in the research, kind of teacher identity can indicate kind of how the teacher sees themselves in the classroom, how they feel they are doing as a teacher, what their philosophy is as a teacher. But I'm more interested in social identities. What are the ways that their religion, their class, their race, their gender, other experiences inform how they think about teaching? Right, what they imagine the role of teaching as, and what their philosophies about teaching are.
And same for students, right? Students have experiences that they bring into the classroom, right? Their experiences in their families, in their communities, how they're treated on the way home from school, on the way to school. So all of these things are at play in the space of one classroom. So when I'm imagining these exchanges and thinking about how they inform the climate, the beliefs and norms of the classroom, the particular behaviors and the philosophies that are informed not just by the teacher, but also by those students in the classroom. And the harder link to make, but I think I do, is how does this impact the teaching and learning, right? That's what's important here, right? How can we understand and make better sense of how those relationships and exchanges inform what happens for our learners? And then, to make it even more complicated, all of those things are embedded in a particular social, political, historical context, right? An institutional context, right? So we have to think about how those outer influences are informing what happens inside the classroom, right? They don't stop at the classroom door. There are things we bring in and we use to make sense of the exchanges in the classroom environment. So I was interested in accounting for that, right? Trying to see how those particular models and structures from outside, the certain kinds of practices and historical experiences come and inform how both the teachers and students make sense of their experiences in the classroom. So, as I mentioned, it's a large northeastern city. I was in two different school communities. One classroom was a math classroom, actually, a seventh grade math classroom, and the other was a language arts classroom. So in some ways, people say, why? That confounds things. It makes it more messy, and this is true. But I was interested, again, not only in how math identities are formed, right, or how identities as readers and writers are formed, which there's much research about. I was interested in how this happens across content areas, and there are different considerations I certainly bumped up against, right? Because there's different kind of space in a math classroom to engage certain kind of issues. In a humanities classroom or the language arts classroom, there are ways in which we could talk about student experiences, or the teacher who I was studying could wrap that into the curriculum, right? Through the particular history they were studying, through particular texts that she engaged, and she was able to make the issues she was interested in, wanted to support students to think through, she was able to hook that onto the curriculum in easier ways than the math teacher was able to do. But anyways, I mentioned that in each of these classrooms, I looked at five teachers. In addition to the two teachers who participated in the study, there were four others, one from one school and three from the second school, and they engaged in a cross-school study group. They came together four or five times over the course of the academic year, and they talked about what happened in their classroom. Here's an incident that I had, not sure what was going on. This is how I responded to it. This is the sense I made of it. What do you think? What might I do in the future? And those conversations had huge impact on how they thought about teaching and the beliefs they had about those students. So that was a really interesting part of this study. I put the demographics up here because, one, they were different, and these two schools were very close to one another. They were about four blocks apart, and you'll notice, for example, the low-income status of the Lewis School was 97%, while 45% the students at the Alexandra Cummer School were low income, so that's really different to have that in such close connection to one another. Yeah, so that's often measured by free and reduced lunch status. So students who are eligible for free and reduced lunch are identified as low income. They're K-8 schools, both of them, actually about the same size. Sorry, I didn't put that up there. About 400 students, K-8, so relatively small in the scope of this district, but representative of the district in terms of demographics, particularly of the Lewis School. One class, the fifth grade language arts class, about 26 students. The seventh grade, about the same, 28 students in those classrooms. So I'll define some terms here, and identity being a very difficult one to define. There are many different kinds of ways in disciplines and within disciplines this kind of definitions are contested, but social categories, race, class, and gender in particular, are perhaps the most salient ways that people are identified
and identify, and also that kind of triumphant race, class, and gender is often studied, right? Not always in an intersected, integral way, but it is often studied. But I believe that identities are multiple and overlapping, right? They shift over time, and they're also different from one context to the next. So kind of who I am may feel and seem and look a little bit different in my home community than the person who I am at school. And that may look different in the next grade level when the teacher who I'm working with allows me to kind of perform in different kinds of ways, allows me to feel differently about my academic ability, allows me to try on different identities. So I do believe that there's ways in which identities shift and change depending on the particular context that an individual is in. At the same time, identities can be fluid. My sense is, and this study kind of bore out, that identity, there is a core identity. There are some things that perhaps remain with me in each of those contexts, right? And those things are often tied to the social, historical, political kinds of events and contexts that get carried along with us, right? And the ways in which those social, political, historical things shape my exchanges in every context kind of creates a sense of core. And so that's contested again. Some people have moved to this idea that there is no core identity. It is always different. It is completely malleable. It will change. And these are kind of postmodern theorists about identity. And I think we have to kind of leave space for both. And so the theoretical frames that I draw upon do this. One's cultural production of identity that comes out of anthropology. And it's the idea that we explore how identities are formed in practice through interactions. So as I kind of talked about. But also interactions not with individuals only, but with the social structures, right? With kind of how the social structures get made into policies and played out in our classroom and other sorts of things. And I hope I'll provide some examples that help us make sense of this. So I believe we can simultaneously examine how cultural, political, and historical ideologies shape society, and at the same time, we can see how the individual has agency and an ability to shape the local context. So there's kind of a push-pull or an exchange. So another theoretical frame that I thought I found useful was those theories, critical theories on race, many coming out of sociology, that says race is a socially and ideologically constructed to serve political, economic, and legal concerns. So critical race theorists, this is a kind of a body of literature that comes out of critical legal studies, they might contest that racial critiques are central to our analysis of various contexts and phenomena, right? So they might go as far as to say, if we don't center race, then we aren't going to have an understanding of the micro and macro level, what's occurring, and we may have an incomplete and inaccurate reading. So I think if I meld these two theories together, I'm left with some new possibilities. I'm left with the possibility that identities may shift depending on context, time, actor, but that a core identity that exists that's tied to social identities, and that that's due to these reoccurring patterns that I mentioned. But I'm also, the other piece is it forces us to pay attention to the intersections of identity, right? It's not just we're one type of person, right? Our gender, our race, our class status, our religions all together inform who we are and how we're going to interact. So therefore, we can say in one particular moment, right, how a teacher or in this case of the classroom, a student may negotiate their gender, race, and class status in one interactional moment. And I think that these types of processes have been largely under-theorized. So, this is the old one. Let's turn to a few examples. This is the seventh grade math classroom. The teacher in the math classroom is a woman in her mid-40s who's been teaching for 5 or 6 years, and she's really focused on supporting her students to work with one another, to learn from one another, and she's actually also interested in helping her students be aware of privilege and to confront racism. And she finds few spaces within her math curriculum to do this, but when she has an opportunity, she goes towards it.
So what I found was that her students, the explanations that they gave for their experiences and how they interpreted what was going on was set against the background of what was said in the classroom and the kinds of discourses that Emily in some ways shaped the teacher. She adopted a stance that she should confront racism, and she applied perspectives of her students, the reflections on her students' behaviors and actions to do this. So oftentimes we kind of think, okay, here's an institution, here's the social history out there, and our behaviors and interactions are separate from this. And what she does is actually tie individual actions and kind of identify where people are complicit in participating in these structures, whether it was her other administrators, teachers, colleagues, and sometimes even her students. Okay, so I'm going to give you an example of when she does this with her students. I argue it's admirable that she kind of takes this head on, but we'll see in a moment it often doesn't result in the desired outcomes that she has. So there's an example in the classroom where students are working in small groups. She has the small groups of students are kind of semi-permanent. Over time, they're working together. And she really challenges them to share their math knowledge, to work collectively, to be responsible for their classmates developing understanding. And this is also supported, though, by her, consciously monitoring what they know, what they don't know, what they're misunderstanding, taking them aside for individual one-on-one support. But in this instance, she sees that three out of a group of students, there's one student really struggling, challenged. He's a black male student, and she notices that the other students aren't supporting him. So she challenges them, and actually she identifies this behavior as racist. So we're not going to talk about whether this is true or not, what was the information, but I want to just kind of talk to you about what sense the students made of this and what she intended. So this school is the Alexandra Crummell School. So lower percentage of low and reduced, I think it was 47. So it's very multiracial, multinational, multilingual, and pretty mixed social demographic. Interestingly enough, one of the contentions of the teacher is that it's same ability group math classroom. So they're tracked in her mind by ability. So her whole class, and this is a practice she contests, right? She thinks that we could do this better if we had heterogeneity group classes, but her groups within the class are intentionally mixed, right? So she actually has semi-permanent groups, five altogether, and she has students who are really strong in particular topic areas in math, and she groups them, and she identifies an expert in a particular area, and they're in charge of teaching that content, like geometry, okay? So that's a good question. It's a homogeneous, or it's a life ability group class. Yeah. Other questions as I continue? So I want to give a little bit more context for the classroom. The incident I describe is happening while students are regularly working through their math tasks in these semi-permanent groups. They're charged with helping each other. And she pulls students aside and she talks with them because she believes they're unwilling to help their black student colleague, and then this is kind of racist. Now, they're confused, her students, about this charge, and I think it initially happens in the classroom setting, and then she follows up individually with students. To a white male student, she has this conversation that I kind of cryptically note up on the screen. She has a one-on-one conversation, and she's trying to help this student understand that his making a decision not to help has larger impact beyond what happens in this classroom, and it's tied to kind of the potential and trajectory of this student in the long run. And she wants to connect it to issues of equity and access. And he actually, from her sense, is open to this conversation, and they have an interesting exchange, which she feels is productive. And at the end, she kind of extends her hand, and she says, "Welcome to Race 101." And he says, "Okay, when are we going to do this again?" And so she actually sees this as an opportunity to concretely connect student behaviors to issues of equity. And she looks for ways to do this whenever she can. So the students leave with a very different understanding.
So we hear Emily's perspective as a teacher, we hear what she sees the white male student understands, and then Ayo, who's not even in this classroom, she's in the classroom that I've observed. She's in a seventh grade math classroom, and her friend comes to her one day at lunch and says, she shares this exchange. She says that this teacher says racist things occasionally. He says that what Emily explained to him is she was afforded particular privileges because she was white, and that he, as an African American boy, would be viewed in a certain way, and people would not provide him the same kinds of access and support that she received. And so this is how Ayo retells the story. Dr. Chalmers pulled him aside, and after everybody left to go down to lunch, he came down and told us that Dr. Chalmers was like, she got to a higher place because she's white and he's just black, and that's why he's stupid or whatever. So the teacher's intention is to demonstrate and make students aware of institutional racism. But what they identify is that she's acting in a racist manner and believes that he is not capable of being successful and that he needs the help of his white student colleagues. Exactly not her intention. So we can argue why this happened. We could think together about what were other ways that she may have presented this issue, made sense of this issue. But one thing that is very interesting is how differently each of the individuals who were engaged in this moment understood the events. So the interview with the person who heard the student with the teacher, right? But not the student in the classroom. So I have a similar story from the seventh grade classroom I was in, but this happened in the eighth grade classroom. So the two students, three at least that we know, who were engaged in the event, I did not have a one-on-one interview with them. Yeah, I had a similar experience because she had a very almost identical conversation with another white male student in the seventh grade class. And it was different in the sense that one of his challenges was engaging socially with his peers. And he said that he had, like, white boy and comments like that were thrown at him. And he talked with Ms. Chalmers about why that was the case. And she actually tried to describe to him that they saw him as privileged and saw him as difficult to take. And she was kind of both trying to say, maybe this is social, not race-based, and maybe he could think about how he positioned himself. And he wouldn't tell me what their conversation was. She did, but he said, you wouldn't understand. So he made assumptions that I couldn't align or understand his perspective, I think because of my background. Does that make sense? So similar exchange, different students, seventh grade and eighth grade classroom. Yeah, yeah. So I had the opportunity to ask him that. That's why I shared it. And it was interesting that he didn't want to reveal to me their exchange. Yeah. Other questions? So I want to tie some of the things this makes me think of in this exchange. I want to kind of analyze what's going on as it relates to other things that occurred in my study and what implications it has. So there are a few things I'd like to explain. One is that you'll notice that I haven't talked about impact. I've talked about how teacher identity and students' identities influence the teaching and learning process. And I think I'm able to demonstrate influence through this study because of how the identities were informed by the interactions with one another, and that particularly classroom discourse served as a vehicle for doing so. So I'm going to take a minute to say a few things. One is that when I talk about discourse, I mean the social language that's employed in the classrooms that enacts certain identities and roles. So I learned that students brought in explanatory theories, and that students and teachers applied them at times. They were based on socially defined groups, and this mediated classroom discourse and teaching and learning processes broadly. So there's this idea that there are cultural models. There's different bits and pieces of information that we have in our heads based upon our experience. And then there are also different bits and pieces of information in a context, right? And those are connected often to cultural groups, in particular practices in a setting. So those things we unconsciously use to shape our stories, and we apply them to the words, concepts, and speech events that we hear. And I think this is exactly what Io is doing. This is exactly what the boy is doing. So it's through these unconscious processes that our identities mediate how we make sense of the discourse. So to be explicit, by mediation, I mean how the ideas and emotions inform our individual participation, right? We see an exchange between Ms. Chalmers and her students, both in a large group and then an individual conversation. So her intention was to support the black male student, but what he left with was he felt that he did not have the abilities that he needed to be productive, and he felt that Dr. Chalmers' ideas were informed by larger historical models, and his day-to-day experiences also helped to make sense of that. So he attached things real and perhaps imagined onto those statements and onto those interactions. What happened when this kind of discourse was embedded in the content of the curriculum? It was very different. So in this classroom, towards the end of the year, students were allowed to do some data collection in a local area, looking at a variety of issues. But it was a kind of statistics unit. They looked at census data, and then they kind of did a collection of data in their neighborhoods. The types of issues that were raised in that embedded discussion were very different, and they made sense more accurately about what teachers were interested, what the teacher was saying, and they were able to form questions and make sense of them through this project, and the teachers could support and engage them in this process. In the other classroom, the same thing happened, and because it was a humanities classroom, there were more and more opportunities to do that. And so that there was a language that was explicit, identified, and shared by the teachers and the students in the classroom, and that was applied to their curriculum investigations. And so there was less space that these kinds of incidents occurred. And so one of the things I kind of suggest is that we have to look for ways to embed the issues and conversations that we think are important to have into our curriculum. Right? And it's harder and harder to do that because we're in a particular moment where curriculum is more and more standardized, and there's less space to kind of know who our students are and to make adjustments and find openings to expand projects and engage in these kinds of issues which may be seen as periphery. And we could even argue that this issue might be periphery because it was kind of naming behaviors without a lot of context. But there are other issues that are really central to students' identity making, and it are also essential to the learning process that we have to set up carefully, explain and define terms carefully, and process carefully. So one of the things in this example is there were individual moments that the teacher grabbed to process, but there was not a whole group process. I would say there's less space for that too over time, but I would also remark that these particular teachers were engaged in networks outside of the district that did this. So they were networks of other educators with similar students and teachers with similar philosophies where they processed there. They were informal but formalized, so they were teacher networks that sat outside of the district in terms of like the school district having a they or are, right? And those were critical. And I also found that the conversations we had, just the eight teachers, were critical. They moved teachers in their thinking, and they helped them rethink and rename and re-kind of shape their beliefs. And that's one of the things in educational research is that it's very hard to see. It's very hard to show. Often we find that the beliefs that we come with or how we were trained, or first even before how we were trained, how we were taught inform our beliefs, and then how we were trained inform our beliefs. And so new information doesn't easily fit on, right? New ways of thinking, new belief structures doesn't easily fit on. And so while less of this happened where students were shifting teachers' beliefs, if we connected students' exchanges with teachers to their peers processing these events, we saw change over the course of that year. And they asked for more of it.
So it was dual in that they didn't really have time and they would kind of participate intermittently, but they said, wow, I wish I had more of that. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's one of the things we talk about, I think, in our department here when we are preparing teachers in particular in the Ed Studies department, is that it's really critical to find these kinds of groups, right, where people have similar kinds of philosophies and beliefs, and that you can take your practice and make sense of it in another space and both get, challenged, reinforced, new ideas, and that those can be brought back to the classroom. And so they exist in every city, and I think it's just helping people identify those kinds of groups. And then I do think that both schools and districts should be responsible for creating those kinds of opportunities. Right? There was a built-in way in which this could have occurred on a very regular basis with a nearby university in this school, and there were numerous supports. Facilitators, and in some ways teachers don't need the facilitator. So one of the challenges of my research, so in a life before this, I worked with networks in Boston doing this kind of work with teachers, so I thought it would be useful to bring that to the teachers, right? I felt like it would be beneficial and I could give something back while doing research. But what happened was they thought I had an agenda. And so that they want to make sure I got the data that I wanted, and they wanted to make sure that they were following my lead. And actually, sometimes the space just needs to be created. Maybe the resource can be pushed in, but the facilitation can be in large part by them, I think.
I'm going to say one or two more things and then see if there are other questions. What I want to just point out is some of the things that I attended to. I'll start with the third bullet. Classroom teachers need to be able to identify ways to connect these issues to their teaching goals within the curriculum. And that we need to pay attention, the questions that the two of you were getting at, how do we support teachers to both engage their students, to be able to process some of these things with their students, and to interrogate their own practices. And if we see that it happens best with their teacher colleagues, we need to figure out ways to do more of that. And then the first point was just that research on teacher beliefs, I mentioned, points to this intractability. And so I think the cross-school study groups plays a really critical role in shifting teachers' belief. And through, I didn't really say much about this, but through life history interviews with these teachers, I was able to make the connection between what their life histories were, what their teaching philosophies were, and how that informed their beliefs, goals, and practices. And then in the study group, I could see those things shifting, right? Those are hard links to make, but the life history interviews helped me to do that with these teachers. And if beliefs are the drivers of action, we're not going to see change in teacher pedagogy. We're not going to see improvement in schools unless we work through those things. So that's a kind of strong statement, but I think that we can't kind of think about improving school communities, improving teaching practice, without getting to who is the teacher, who are the students they're teaching, what are the particular beliefs they bring, how are their philosophies formed, and how can we interrogate those, change those, which is going to change practice. I think that's a critical thing. I think it has to happen as we think about teacher preparation, but what often happens is we think about it there, and then we forget to do the follow-up and support once we have early career teaching, right? So one of another kind of research study I did was kind of thinking about a school of education that actually embeds this reflection, this community-engaged learning, the teaching, student teaching while doing coursework, right? It's an urban teaching program, and these are implicit pieces of the program. But once the teachers enter the school system, the particular district practices and policies don't allow them to perform those kinds of practices, right? And so we have to do two things. We have to support them to be reflective, to be engaged, to question, and to understand the context and community where they're going to teach. And we also have to prepare them for the current context of
schools and large urban districts maybe in particular, but generally kind of the particular standards and curriculum that they're going to receive and the kinds of assessments and mandates they're going to have to confront and figure out how they negotiate those students, right? So, and that's where the networks come in, because they support the negotiation of those students and they give teachers ideas and ways and kind of a way to stand firm in what their beliefs are and how to make sense of them within the context of their teaching. It's both and. We have to think about creating more diverse teaching forces, but given the teaching force that exists, to say that isn't going to really help us much, right? Because the individuals who are teaching are predominantly white middle-class women, particularly in urban communities. I'd say it's 80 to 90% of the workforce. So to just talk about matching isn't going to get us very far. And because I believe that our work as teachers and who we are and that processing these things everybody can engage in and that will improve practice, I think that that's just as important to talk about. Right? And I think that we have to be really explicit about how that happens, and we have to kind of prepare teachers for what to look for, how to make sense of what behaviors they're seeing, how to think about their particular role in the process, and that I may be even more interested in that because the other remedy is important, but it's a long way towards being reflected, very long way towards being reflected. And I think we get in trouble when we kind of say, you know, X teacher can only teach in X community. And I think there's a lot of anxiety. For me, I feel like there's a lot of anxiety for people who are really dedicated and committed about that issue. And I want to kind of get it out the way and kind of focus on what we can do. And I also think everybody has work, even if there's a match. Yeah. And in this study, that came out. So the basically, sorry, Tania, I'm coming. What happened was this teacher, Emily, who I talk about, said how the black teachers in the Lewis School kind of could connect automatically. They didn't have to do as much work. And those teachers were really kind of not comfortable with that. Because they did come from the community. They did understand their students. They had ways to explicitly address those issues, but they also had to work at it, and they also had to, you know, there were also bumps and misunderstandings. So I think that's why it's really important for it to be connected to the curriculum, right? So it can't, if a parent says to me, that has nothing to do with math, why are you teaching that? You have no business teaching that to my kid, and you're just plain wrong, right? They may have some good points, right? But I also believe that there are ways, there are authentic moments all the time that are connected to the content that we're teaching young people that can be rolled into the you know, academic work of the classroom. And I think because I can't separate the kind of identity work from the academic work, that's what I would kind of have to talk through with the parent who said that. But there are ways, I mean, some of these issues are really difficult and contested, and there are probably some that are inappropriately handled in a classroom, which can do more damage, right? And I think you maybe have questions about that, right? There could be times that we mishandle it so much that it does more damage than good, and that we have to be really careful about that. But I think that another way, rather than to kind of steer people away from it, is to get them really prepared and support them to do it, right? In responsible ways. So. All right.
So I'm working on this book project that is going to do two things that connects to this study. I'm just going to share a little bit and then kind of let you go find your children and kind of explore the campus. So one of the things that I am up to is interviewing these focal students who next fall will be sophomores and seniors in high school. So my project is really how these identities, how they happen in the moment. So my follow-ups will just to be to kind of think about who they see themselves as now and where their academic trajectory has taken them. Right? I can't say kind of who they are in their classroom and what's happening with the exchanges with different teachers. That's a kind of a different thing. But I think it will be very informative in terms of how they were seen and experienced school 5 years ago, 6 years ago now, and where they are now. And the other really, really important piece to me of this study was the two teachers that I worked with were extraordinary teachers, really well prepared, really able to engage their students, and had great results. And they were engaged in networks. They were reflective practitioners. One is now at a local university, and another is a principal at a charter school. They have masters and PhDs, and they are engaged in research as well, right? So I am interested in having them reflect with me how this research experience impacted their beliefs, their teaching process, and how they think of themselves, and also for them to share with other teachers and other folks in the field what they learned, what this meant for their instructional practice, and how this sort of research can be supportive, and what the challenges are. And so I feel like their voices are just as important as my analysis, so I'm really figuring out a way to co-write with them a chapter of this book that I'm writing up. So I will end there, and I will thank you for coming, and I look forward to meeting you or your students in the near future, your children. Thank you.